Yes, Your Honor. This is Carlos Hutchison, and I represent the appellant, Curtis Mason, in this matter.
Mr. Hutchison? Mr. Hutchison? Judge
Hutchison,
Biddy?
Yes. Can you all hear me?
Are you using a speakerphone?
I am.
Would you please pick up your handset? It's cutting out, and I'm having a hard trouble hearing you.
Sure. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Is that better?
That's much better.
That's much better. Thank you. Mr. Hutchison, do you wish to reserve any rebuttal time?
I do, Your Honor. We get 10 minutes or 15?
15 minutes. Total.
If I could preserve five?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, Honorable Chief Judge and Judges of the Court of Appeals, the appellant requests that this court reverse his conviction for possession of cocaine with the intent to distribute third or subsequent offense for the following reasons: that the trial court erred in allowing evidence of appellant's prior convictions to be presented to the jury for third or subsequent purposes. And it's our argument that the prior convictions are not substantially similar, and that's the issue we have before us. The prior convictions in this case are not substantially similar for several reasons. One, 18.2248C, which is the code section that the appellant is charged under, requires possession, whether it be active or constructive, as the Supreme Court recently stated in Jordan v. Commonwealth.
Mr. Hutchison, this is Judge Petty. On that point, both of these statutes, these New York statutes, criminalize the sale of controlled substance. Am I correct there?
Yes, Your Honor.
18.2-248 also uses the word sell as being one of the proscribed acts. We, to the best of my knowledge, we have never defined the word sell for purposes of this statute. Suppose we were to take that up and decide that the definition of sale has to be something different than possession with intent to distribute, so therefore possession is not a necessary element of sale. Would that impact your argument?
On that point, Your Honor, it would, because as my research has revealed, as it stands now, possession is, in fact, and there's no presumption in Virginia.
The possession element has been addressed in the context of possession with intent to distribute, and perhaps the distribution. But I don't think we've ever decided a case that defined the word sell under our statute. How should we define that using the common statutory construction rules?
Well, Your Honor, I believe sell, which would be a question that I haven't considered, because in this case he's charged with possession with intent. I didn't consider what difference it would make if it were sell. But sell would be in accord with the People v. Samuels case. They found that defendant, Samuels, could sell even though he did not possess. If the Virginia courts decided that 18.2248 should be interpreted the same way, I guess it would be in line, and on that point, it would be substantially similar. The problem we have, though, is in New York, there is a presumption of knowing possession. If a person is found in the car, there's a presumption that he knowingly possessed it, as opposed in Virginia, simple proximity, there is no presumption. What would be another distinction between the two statutes. Further, 18.2, and this is the crux of our argument, 18.2248C contemplates Schedule 1 and 2 drugs only for the enhanced punishment. The New York statutes, one says narcotic, and then it lists several other drugs, some which are not Schedule 1 or 2. All narcotics are not Schedule 1 or 2. So simply based on the reading of the statute, which is what Dilsworth v. Commonwealth instructs us to do, look at the elements of the two offenses, you can't say that they are substantially similar. Further, New York Statute 220.31.
This is Judge McCullough.
Yes, Judge.
One question I had was about the timing of your objection, because was this a bench or a jury trial?
It was a jury trial.
A jury trial, right, okay. So, and ordinarily our cases require a timely objection to the admission of evidence, meaning before or at the time it's entered into evidence. But many of these arguments came after the trial was over with. So how do we clear that hurdle of the, because under 518, an objection has to be specific and timely. And so, particularly with a jury trial, you know, they've heard the evidence. It's kind of hard to unring that bell. Anyway, it'd be helpful to me if you could address that.
Well, Judge, the appellant filed a motion in limine prior to the trial, requesting that the court limit the jury's exposure to these prior convictions without showing that they're substantially similar. Because, as you mentioned, once the bells ring, it's ring. You can't pull it back. So they did have that motion in limine prior to the actual trial before
the
court.
Yeah, but that was a different argument, wasn't it, than the post-trial motion where you identified a number of features of the New York statute that are different from the Virginia statute?
Somewhat, Your Honor, and if I could address that this way. Also, when the exhibits were offered by the Commonwealth, there was an objection made. Now, the court has held that once you make an objection, you're objecting to all elements of that. I believe I mentioned it in my reply. All elements of that objection. So if you're objecting to whether it's substantially similar, it's our position that an element of substantially similar is that that the two codes, the two elements of the codes are similar. We think that entails all of the argument and not specifically whether there's a possession element, whether the controlled substance is defined, whether the narcotic is defined. And the Commonwealth has the burden in this case. So he made a timely objection. The court overruled his objection, and they went forward when the exhibits were.
This is Judge Petty. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think are these as proof of the two prior conviction elements of the offense for which he was convicted?
Yes, Your Honor. Because he's convicted of an enhanced third or subsequent.
So your argument, particularly your second assignment of error, where you're talking about the motion to set aside the jury verdict, would have been a sufficiency of the evidence argument as well as an admission of evidence argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thanks.
And actually, when the appellant brought it up at sentencing, the judge said that we don't think there's any new argument here, and he actually raised additional points, but those points had already been raised. The court knew what the issues were, and the question is whether the statutes are substantially similar. Further, Your Honor, and I believe those are our points as to why they are not. One, the New York statute 220.31 lists only controlled substance, which it has to be Schedule 1 or 2 under 18.2248. They're not substantially similar. We feel that's clear, and I believe the Commonwealth agrees with that. The question is whether the other one, 220.39, they list narcotic, whether that would suffice to say that's Schedule 1 or 2 and therefore be substantially similar. One other point we raised was that under these New York statutes, you could be convicted of selling NyQuil and under this code, which isn't substantially similar to 18.2248C, which is strictly and only Schedule 1 and 2. And I'd like to preserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very well. You have 6 minutes remaining.
Thank you.
Ms. Tyson?
Yes, sir. May it please the court, this is Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. And frankly, this case falls between Dean and Dilsworth. And it is the Commonwealth's position as far as the merits go, especially with regard to the 220-31, that that this is more like Dilsworth than it is like Dean. I do want to address the procedure.
This is Judge Petty. Let me ask you a question on that point.
Mm-hmm.
As far as that 220.31 statute, that permits the conviction for the sale of any controlled substance, correct?
It does. It absolutely does. It's a catch-all statute. Mm-hmm.
And the statute we're dealing with is limited to Schedule 1 and 2 controlled substances.
That is correct, under C. It's interesting because actually 18.2.248, if you go from A through E, it covers just about everything, but the pertinent subsection is C, and that is Schedule 1 or Schedule 2. Mm-hmm.
But it also makes the distribution of a Schedule 5 controlled substance a misdemeanor. And
that is correct.
It appears that the New York statute would make that a felony.
It would be that lowest kind of felony. Yes, it would. The 3-1 statute is the catch-all. It's the one that you can have sold heroin or you can have sold Xanax, and
so
it will be covered by that statute.
With the knowledge that it covers any controlled substance, and our statute only deals with 1 and 2, at least the statute subsection under which he was charged, Why aren't those not substantially similar?
Okay. Well, my response to that would be twofold. And one of them is that the argument about what is included in the statute was not preserved. And I can touch on that later.
I'm more interested
by 580.
Response.
Secondly, I think because of what happened at the post-trial hearing, yes, this was a jury trial, but the issue of whether these crimes in New York are substantially similar was a legal issue, and the court ruled on that issue. And at the motion to set aside, the court still had the ability to rule on the issue of substantial similarity. At that point, the Commonwealth proffered, and no one said otherwise, that the drug that was involved in two of the cases in New York was cocaine. Well, certainly that would be involved in the 220.39 case, but it necessarily had to be the drug in one of the 220.31 cases. And that cocaine is a Schedule II drug in Virginia and New York. And so even though, as Dean would say, Dean would hold, well, we're looking at the elements and not the conduct. But Dilsworth holds, if you can tell what part of the statute was violated, then you don't have to, the entire statute doesn't have to comply. So it's my argument that because there was evidence that the schedule of drug that was involved was a Schedule 2, that just as in Dilsworth, that conviction of attempted sale qualifies as substantially similar, because he was...
Do you have any support for the argument that the Commonwealth in a jury trial can introduce substantive evidence at sentencing? That seems to me a little bit bizarre.
Well, here is the reason that I think this can happen. I'm not suggesting that it is substantive evidence. It is evidence with regard to the issue of a legal matter only. If you look at the jury instruction, the jury was not asked to decide whether one of these or any of these statutes were substantially similar. They were instructed that if they found he had been convicted of a prior offense, then they could convict him of the subsequent offense in this instance. And so this is purely a legal issue, and the jury, as the fact finder, was not involved in making that decision at all. Only the trial judge was. And the trial judge could have, at that post-trial hearing, have said, you know, I was wrong before about substantial similarity. They're not. I'm going to grant your motion to set aside, and we're going to have a trial on either possession with intent second or whatever decision the court would make. That's why I think, because this legal issue was still in the breast of the trial court, that this argument can be made.
Did the trial judge ever make a finding after the assistant Commonwealth attorney made this statement at sentencing? Did he make a finding of substantial similarity? Because it looks to me like this statement was made more for purposes of arguing for punishment than it was on the issue of whether these statutes were admissible.
Right. It actually comes up twice. It comes up once when the judge is ruling on the motion to set aside, and that's going to be on page 103. And the judge is saying it's substantially similar. And then the judge says, this is the very top of the page, line 2, if my memory serves me correct, it's the same controlled substance that was convicted for in New York. It's the same substance for which he was charged here in Virginia, to wit, cocaine. So the judge is saying this. Now, there was no evidence at the jury trial about what the drug was, so he's not remembering it from that. And then, unfortunately, not in the appendix, we cited to the page 10 of the sentencing transcript. This is when the prosecutor is arguing about sentencing, and he mentions on page 10 that he's pointing to the pre-sentence report and indicates that the convictions in 1998 and 92 were for cocaine.
So your argument is that prior to the proffer of what the drugs were in New York, the court made a ruling.
That's right, on this legal issue, yes, it did. And
what
the court made.
What did it make that ruling? What evidence did it make that ruling on if the proffer had not yet occurred?
Well, I don't know. I can say that the prosecutor made reference to the pre-sentence report. I can say that my review of the record, that I did not find that the Commonwealth introduced evidence at the jury trial with regard to what the drug was. And again, I think it might get back to the original question, can a trial judge do this post-trial? And because of the nature of the issue, namely that it is a legal issue about substantial similarity, that the court was in a position to make that decision. And I will move on. I'll address the merits of the 221-39. Before I get back to the procedural argument, because in that regard, in my estimation, there's really no question that there is substantial similarity with 220.39. And the reason there is because this one is charged as 39, and then there's an 01. And if you look at the statute, the 39 statute, 01 is narcotic drug. And then if you follow the New York statute, here's my paper. If you follow the New York statute to statute 220-00 number 7, narcotic drug is defined as controlled substance listed in Schedule 1B, 1C, 2B, 2C, other than methadone. So clearly narcotic drug, as far as these statutes are concerned in New York, is a Schedule 1 or Schedule 2, and not just any Schedule 1 or Schedule 2, but I also checked the schedule, and 2B is where you find cocaine. So this clearly...
Judge Petty, again, on that statute, the argument, it looks to me, that the appellant is making on that is that the judicially defined scope of that statute allows for a conviction of someone who does not either constructively or actually possess a drug.
Okay, I understand understood that to be one of the arguments, yes.
Okay, that's one of them. It looks to me like the trial court rejected the concept that he was required to determine whether the statute was substantially similar based not only on the language of the statute, but also the judicial interpretation that went along with it. Would that be fair?
I think that he made comments that could be interpreted that way.
Haven't we said in Dean that in order to determine substantial similarity, we have to look at the interpretation given to the statute by the court?
Oh, I don't remember that it was a requirement. I certainly know the court did that in Dean, and they looked at the case law with regard to robbery and what would constitute robbery. In this case, even if the trial judge were incorrect in not looking at case law, for a couple of reasons, it would be harmless, because first of all, there's no question that this statute is substantially similar when you look at the actual crime for which this defendant was convicted. Because you have the 01, which makes this not only substantially similar but identical
statute. Would it be substantially similar if in New York you could be convicted under the statute for never having possessed either actually or constructively the drug
Yes.
Virginia.
And
Virginia, someone at least has to be in possession of the drug in order to be convicted.
I think that the arguments that were presented by the prosecutor at the motion in limine hearing and the court's response to those arguments answer that, in that you can have concert of action and you can have principal in the second degree. And in either of those cases, if you want to call it brokering or countenancing or aiding and abetting or whatever words you want to use, you can certainly have someone convicted who is not in the actual or constructive possession of the drug. We have that in Virginia.
Someone would have to be in actual or constructive possession in order for there to be concert of action or principal of second degree. In New York, it looks like if you have the ability to go out and get the drug, if you agree to sell it, you've committed the crime.
I would disagree based on that Samuels case, and that Samuels case is the one that the defendant relied on to make that argument. There was actual cocaine there amongst this group of people, and the undercover police officer was never able to have it because he refused to take a hit off the pipe. But even though the defendant Samuels didn't have it, somebody did. So I think that interpretation of Samuels would be too broad, and I think that that would not make New York statute fail to be substantially similar to Virginia's statute. And I'll point out as well that the argument about the presumption statute in New York, I know the defense made an argument about it's the opposite of what we have in Virginia, that if you're in an automobile, everybody in the automobile is not presumed to possess the drug, and there's a statute quite to the contrary in New York. That argument was not made to the trial judge. It's barred by 5A18. I would also say that it's not like Chenault, however, because it's not a conclusive presumption. There's an ability to prove. It's rebuttable. And so even if you address the merits of that one, then it is does not make statutes fail to meet that substantial similarity test. With regard, if I have a little bit of time left on the procedural argument, I would say that the issue about 220-31 including too many types, too broad an array of drugs, was not made at the motion in limine. I will readily agree that the defendant argued if you can be convicted of something in the foreign state that you can't be convicted of in Virginia, there's a lack of similar similarity. However, his argument focused totally on this possession argument that he was making. And so that's the argument that the court was listening to. The prosecutor answered with the principal and the second and the concert of action. So with the written motion in limine and the argument on the motion in limine, which of course both just addressed when can the Commonwealth bring this up. And so we're looking at 60 to 61 in the appendix for the written motion, 5 through 11 in the appendix for the argument. Then when the conviction orders were admitted, which is pages 20 to 21, the defendant said, I would again like to argue. And my position would be simply saying that if you can be convicted of something in New York that you can't be convicted of under the most similar statute in Virginia, the statutes are not substantially similar. That merely making that argument is not sufficient when the defendant then goes on and makes a particular argument, and his particular argument did not have anything to do with how many different kinds of drugs were in a particular statute.
But isn't it the burden of the Commonwealth to establish similarity at the outset?
Well, it is the burden of the Commonwealth, but when the only argument that one is making to the judge is it's not substantially similar because of this possession issue, that's the only issue that the trial court is being asked to address. It's the only issue that the Commonwealth is then asked to rebut. And so the issue is not fairly before the trial court under circumstances as such as we have here. That's why it's procedurally barred. And then when the issue is brought up at the post-trial written motion and at the argument on the post-trial written motion, the trial judge says, I don't hear anything new here. Well, this would be a new argument, and counsel didn't say, well, I have this other argument about how many different drugs are contained in the statute, and did not advise the court that it needed to rule on more than just one issue or two issues, that here's a new issue, the court hasn't ruled on it before, which is why we cited the Reiner case, that if you make more than one argument, then you must get a ruling on all of those arguments. And then, of course, the court made the comment about how it was, if memory served, that the drug involved in New York was cocaine. And there was no argument from the defense of that's not the evidence that you heard or that's incorrect. And so the court made its ruling in that regard. And as far as...
if you could wrap it up, your time is about up.
Your Honors, I want you just to rely on the arguments then that I have made on brief and answer any questions that the court may have. It is our position this case is more like Dilsworth than it is like Dean, and we would urge this court to affirm.
Very well. Thank you. Thank you. Rebuttal, Mr. Hutchison?
Yes, Your Honor. First, I'd like to address the whether there was one or more arguments preserved. When the appellant argued post-trial, quote was, the statutes are not substantially similar because New York statute permits prosecution for the sale of controlled substances which appeared in any schedule. And that was preserved, and the trial judge said, well, I don't hear any new argument here. The question is, what was the appellant to do at that point? He made his argument. He preserved his exception. And I cited Virginia Code 18.01384. Once he preserved his argument, he's not required to argue with the judge who's about to sentence his client that, well, judge, you this is a new argument, you're hearing this wrong. You recall cocaine, but that wasn't in the evidence. That's a risky thing for any counsel to do when he has a client that he's arguing for, but he did what he was supposed to.
This is judgment. Why isn't the answer, I mean, you know ahead of time, because you filed a motion in limine, what these statutes were going to be. So you parse them and you do the research, so you make all the arguments up front
right
prior to this going to the jury, and then you're not in this bind of post-trial motions based on things that could have been figured out, you know, at the outset. I mean, I imagine that would be the Commonwealth's response to that.
And Your Honor, the Commonwealth, what makes it difficult is the Commonwealth has the burden. So the defendant comes in, he says, Your Honor, well, we object to these coming in until the Commonwealth meets their burden. The Commonwealth says, well, look at them, they're the same. And essentially it's the defendant's burden to prove that they are dissimilar in that case, because the Commonwealth is simply saying, well, they both say controlled substances, they're the same, and their burden... The argument
right,
is...
Right, but on appeal, I mean, we're not going to generally reverse a trial judge unless an argument was made with specificity and in a timely fashion. I mean, those are cases, and I think sometimes I find myself in disagreement with them, but I have to follow them. And so I don't mean to use up all your time, but that's the part of the case that I struggled with.
And we'd argue that the... you know, when it's evidentiary issues, it's a question of law, it's reviewed de novo, it's not a discretionary item, for one. And then two, Your Honor, and this is, we cited Commonwealth v. Herring, where the Supreme Court addressed the issue of preservation of issues on appeal. And the court held that by arguing, in that case it was an abduction statute in its entirety, that statute wasn't satisfied, counsel preserved his challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence as to every statutory element of abduction. Our argument would be our challenge to the Commonwealth's that they hadn't met their burden was substantially similar. By arguing that, we preserved our challenge to every statutory element of substantially similar, which means... you're looking at the elements of the charge, that the Commonwealth hadn't proven that. And I believe that the codes, just a clear look at the codes state that 220.31 says controlled substance. That's overly broad, and I think it's clear that's not similar. The question is 220.39. The Commonwealth argues that it says 01, and therefore the 01 means narcotic. Looking at the statute, page 63, there is no 01. There's a 1. Perhaps that 1, perhaps that's what the 01 stands for, but we don't know that. Just looking at the statute itself, which is what Dean and Dilsworth, I believe, instruct us to do, you could be convicted under 220.39 for actions that you couldn't be convicted of under 18.2248. And that is our entire argument. They're not substantially similar because you can be convicted for acts that you can't be convicted for under that statute. The question as to whether there was a proffer by the Commonwealth that it was cocaine, I believe that was after the trial. One, two, I don't think that's evidence. Three, I don't know if the appellant's failure to object to the Commonwealth's proffer negates any of his argument. When the judge says he believes it was cocaine, and I went through the transcripts, there was never any mention that it was, I don't believe, cocaine prior to that moment.
Your time expired, so if you can wrap it up, please.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Your Honor, we'd argue that the issues were preserved by the motion in limine, by the motion to set aside. We would argue that the codes are not substantially similar. We would humbly request that the court reverse this conviction and allow the court, instruct the court to look at this again, that the 220.31 is not substantially similar, and we'd argue that the 0.39 is neither is that. That is not substantially similar either. And then we'd also argue if the court finds that the issues were not preserved, we'd submit that the ends of justice exception would apply in this case.
Very well. We thank you very much for your argument, sir. And Ms. Tyson.